Hello, everyone, and welcome back to RPG R&D. I am one of your hosts, Jess Geyer. I'm one half of Wannabe Games, and I make tabletop role-playing games, and sometimes I play them. And I'm here, as always, with my co-host, Craig Campbell. Hello, Craig.
Hi, Jess. I'm Craig Campbell. I'm the owner of Nerdburger Games. I also make tabletop games, and I do play them as well. In fact, I'm playing a game tomorrow. And we are here with a returning guest, Joey. Hello, Joey. Welcome aboard.
Hey, thanks for having me back. I'm Joey Martin, and I own Drowning Moon Studios, where I design all sorts of weird games. And sadly, I don't get a chance to play them terribly often these days, which is kind of sad.
You know, we say things like that. Like, I know a lot of game designers say, like, oh man, I never have time for games. I don't play them anymore. I'm sure that we, even with our low amount of games that, like, I feel like I play, and I'm assuming the same is the true for you, Joey, we play way more than the average person.
That is probably true, actually.
We always compare ourselves to people who are like, well, I'm in 3 or 4 campaigns, and they've been running for 2.5 years. And
right.
Those days are long in the past.
Yep.
For me. Yeah. And I think probably for most designers and publishers, because there's just, you know, so much other stuff you got to do.
And there's so many games out there.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
But we're not talking about that.
Yeah. Well, we're speaking of so many games, we're going to talk about like some different types, some things that you might run into with some of these different types of games. And I'm going to ask Jess to set us up here for our GMing topic, because this was something you threw up into the list of topics that we keep handy, and Joey snagged in immediately. So clearly both of them are very interested. So Jess, set us up.
Yeah. Today we are talking about pre-casting your game. So pre-casting your game means you are providing characters for your players. You are, and we're so used to like the traditional style of role-playing games where the players are going to be making their characters, maybe even at the table. You're rolling them up, you're designing your own backstories, and everyone, like the players, have total agency over who they are playing and what that is like. But there is also a tradition of providing those characters, providing a cast for your game. And it does provide, as someone who's been on both sides of this, it does provide a different experience for the gameplay and as a GM. And Joey, I put this on the list because I recently have had 2 experiences doing this. And I'm curious about why you snagged up this topic and what your experience is.
So part of it is because I have a lot of experience also doing LARP design and LARP participation. And a lot of times in single shot LARPs, all of the characters are pre-written and you just cast the players as whichever type of character that they're most interested in. And I like that I'm starting to see that more in tabletop gaming as well, where like a particular game will say, here's a cast of characters, you can choose one, this is what they are, this is what they can do, and then you kind of make it your own through playing it. I think it's really interesting to take it like out of LARP and onto the tabletop table, especially because a lot of times when we're doing things like demos at conventions, we create pre-made characters just to like save time or help people jump into the game quicker. So I think it's an interesting movement in tabletop, and I would love to see more of it.
Yeah, I put it on the list because I just did a LARP, but did a one-shot LARP. It was a Nordic-style vampire LARP. So Nordic-style is just apparently all I am a noob to that particular play style, but basically, hey, here's your character, and go act, go have fun. There is not really a rule. And then like we had a great time, and I thought about how easily that style of gameplay, like my assumption had been with a bunch of new LARPers, some people had never LARPed in that game before, and I had never LARPed in a game where my character was decided for me ahead of time. I've always created my own, and my assumption had been like, oh, that's actually going to be a little harder, like to get into the role play, to get into the character, to get into the story. And instead I found the opposite was true, that it really helped level the playing field between some people who had years of experience playing vampire games. And like, I've had minimal experience playing vampire games, but I have played them. And then the complete noobs to it. And like you really couldn't tell the difference between them when you were just like out there playing, except for maybe sometimes, I don't know, sometimes the newer players who didn't understand the lore too much would ask the GM some questions every once in a while. But I mean, I did that too. So I thought it was a very interesting thing and I wanted to talk about it here. And, you know, for tabletop games too, I have done this, actually not knowing until recently that this was a LARP. This is kind of like a LARP tradition. Whereas my first experience with it was in tabletop role-playing games at conventions.
Yeah, I think having pre-made characters for things like LARP or even things like tabletop, it tends to make things more accessible to new players who are new to this particular style of game.
Yeah,
it takes the pressure off of them to try to like define someone that fits well with the world. And a lot of them, especially in LARPs, you come with connections to other characters. So you've got that built-in, like, you know who you're going to be playing with, you know what kind of relationships these characters have, and they're kind of like just jumping off points to try to like make your play experience more rich and more more complex.
Yeah, I like I said, I've seen this too in tabletop role-playing games. I do think it works really well, especially for games where the lore is like, and the backgrounds are so important to like move play through. Like, it's when you have a big cast, like in a LARP, you have a much larger cast typically than you would at a table. Like, you could have 10, 20, 30, 100 people. And having those character interactions are so important. It's what propels the story forward. And like at a one shot, you also don't have all that time to like dive deeply into like, here's what everybody needs to know, here's blah blah blah, here's why you would do this, here's why this is important, why that is important, why this does or does not need to happen, and like just giving them that information just from the get-go, like, I don't know, I think that's kind of genius. When I would run games for at conventions for Clockwork Dominion, and I ran a couple adventures, like some of the pre-made adventures that they had, and they had pre-casted, well, they didn't pre-cast, that for me implies like putting these people into the roles, but they had some pre-gen characters with backstories already there, and it helped the players without me having to explain every little detail about, you know, the important world. It helped show the players like, oh, this thing appeared in my backstory, I know that that's important, I'm going to go off of this. Like, I don't have to feel awkward, like you said. You don't have to worry so much about how your character's fitting in. You already fit in. Now you're just kind of playing it. And with those two, I think like you said, with having the character connections, having the goals already in place for your character, so you know what you're doing. I don't know. I think that that's like, again, genius. Like, that's a genius thing to have for new players. Like, oh, I don't know how to role play, I don't know what I'm doing, what I'm supposed to do. Well, here's my goal. Let me try to make this happen. And everyone kind of knows how to achieve a goal, hopefully, by the time they start playing role playing games. I don't know how well this would work for like a 5-year-old who doesn't know what goals are and how to get their way.
the thing that strikes me the most about this from a GMing perspective is that, you know, in the best campaigns, in the campaigns where, or, you know, the most kind of complete and complex campaigns, you've got characters that are, you know, dealing with particular story arcs, and they're, you know, going up against villains or situations, challenges. And then there's, you know, whatever the character interactions are, the personalities, the clashes, the things that are, you know, driving, kind of drama between players. And in a game where the players are creating their characters and perhaps don't have their characters fully realized until they get a few sessions in and they start to play the characters and they start to see the group dynamic, and where the story's going, the GM will often be able to start to draw out pieces of character backstory or character relationships that develop and integrate that into the story. Further down the road, because that it may not be immediately apparent, it may take time to develop. It may just make more sense that it's going to take until this particular story arc before this particular character pairing relationship becomes somehow important. Whereas where if you're giving characters to the players right at the outset with all of that sort of stuff built in, you're still doing all of that work. You're still, you know, kind of crafting the story to kind of hit on all that stuff, but you're doing it all very upfront. Like you're spending a lot of time crafting how the characters are going to interact with each other, what their goals are going to be in the stories, even including perhaps, you know, something that's not immediately apparent as a particular story arc or challenge. You know, I might give Jess a character that has a hatred of a particular situation or a particular phobia or something, and we might not see that come to play until like a really dramatically appropriate moment, kind of late in the arc of this main story that we're going to tell. But I can plan for it. I can give you this seed, and it not only allows you to set that up and have that play out for the character and for the player when you get there, but it creates a little bit of tension for the player, because if a savvy player is going to look at that character sheet and they're going to say, everything on here is important. The GM wants all of this. So at some point I'm going to have to deal with this thing. So I have to start thinking about like, how am I going to play this character to react to the situation? How am I going to play my character to interact with a particular person that has been mentioned in my backstory that we have not met yet? So it creates like a very different sort of tension for the player building into something. And I think that if it's a game that's combat heavy, with potentials of, you know, characters dying and really dire consequences, if it's a horror game in particular, like that can create like an interesting nervousness and anxiety that can be part of like the build up to those things, which could be a lot of fun. And like you said, Jess and Joey, both like this is the doing this way is generating a different experience. So like if everybody's on board for that experience, like the players are going to be like, oh, everything on here is important. Like, what do they have planned? What's coming? And they might start to try to figure it out for themselves. And the players might talk about it and like postulate ideas and try to guess where something is going to come into play. Or when he gets really good is when the GM can drop like, here's the hint that's going to say, oh, now here it comes. Like now we're going to give you the direct foreshadowing of this thing that's going to become important at the end of this session or at the next session.
Yeah, I definitely think GMing the style of game does require like a lot of pre-work before you actually get to the game part itself. But the trade-off is that once you have written these characters and seeded their backgrounds with things that are going to be important or the connections that they're going to have with the other characters, it means a lot of times you can give them what you have prepared and just kind of let them go. And they will sometimes just generate their own plot based on stuff that you have put in their character sheet or their backgrounds. I run a Olympic Greek mythology noir LARP, and all of the characters in that are pre-written with connections and stuff like that, but it's also a murder mystery at its heart, and a lot of the characters have bits and pieces of clues that are seeded through the character sheets, so if they talk to each other and figure things out, they can solve the mystery. And I think it's really hard to do something like a mystery like that without providing things for a character or the character's background. It's a bit more challenging for players to have the right direction to go if you want to do that style of game. So pre-generating, pre-creating characters for them to play helps them quite a lot.
I think what might like make people who are used to having their players generate everything and kind of go along with that, and then like the GM writes a story around those things, what they might really balk at is like, oh, now that stuff isn't exciting anymore. Like that's the exciting part of the game. Or, oh, I give them all this background information and now they're going to know how to use it. And that's like going to ruin the surprise, going to ruin the tension. It's not about like railroading the players into that. It's like you've created this beautiful world that you want people to play in. And like you said, Joey, it is a lot of work. The character packets we got for this LARP we did were gigantic. And I know that it took hours and hours of time. But again, it did pay off. In my opinion, everyone had a blast. I had a blast. And I don't think that like, even if you know something's going to happen, even if you have a hint about what an ending of the story might be, sometimes that is sometimes that is more exciting than completely not knowing that, like, dramatic irony intention, like, ooh, I know this is going to blow up. I know that there's some conflicts here, and that can give you like that same feeling is going up on a roller coaster. You know, the drop is about to come and it's not happening yet, but you are getting like that feeling in your stomach, that excitement. I don't know. It's a different kind of fun in a game. Joey, you mentioned the pre-casting of people, fitting the players into how, like, what character they're interested in. How have you seen GMs assign these characters once they have your backgrounds created for your characters and for your players? How have you seen people go about, or how have you gone about assigning those roles once that's all set up?
So with games I run that have pre-cast characters, like the LARP that I just mentioned, we have a form that each of the players fills out that is like, what types of player are you interested in? Do you want to solve mysteries? Do you want romance? Do you want puzzles? Things like that. And then also I include things like, what do you not want to interact with? Like, are there things that you would prefer to shy away from? Like, some people don't like playing romantic relationships in games. So on the form, they would be like, yeah, I'm not really down with this. I would like something different. And it is a lot of administrative work, but usually what we do is, after we get the forms, is we match the player to the play style that they're requesting. So if we have, let's say, in Concord Olympus, which is the Greek noir LARP, we have people who play law enforcement officers. And if I see on someone's casting form that they're interested in playing like a detective, or they're interested in exploring like police corruption, things like that, then they're more likely to get a role of one of those characters than other things in the game. And it's basically just like letting players dictate what their play styles are and what they're looking for to play, and then matching them to the character that best fits that particular style.
Yeah. For me, I was just given a character, but the people already knew me. And I think as a GM, if you do know, if it's not like random strangers playing, I think you can kind of figure out like what they would want to do. But I know that the other players in the LARP I was in did fill out some sort of form. That seems really tough. Like, that seems like the hardest part after writing all of this, is making sure that you're assigning those roles to people that would be a good match, and also not... Maybe it's not as big of a deal for a one shot where you know everyone's going to show up, but if you're GMing for strangers and you assign a role that's like super important to somebody and they need to show up and then they don't, like I can see how that can completely topple, like can ruin. I think you have to prepare for that as a GM, and that seems like so tough. I've only done this for one shots, and I've only written this stuff once. I did it at the most recent Gen Con. I wrote up backstories for characters. And I thought, like, well, I hope I at least have two people. but if I have three, like, here's the order I need to set these things up in. Here's who I don't need the most. Here's the most central character. Not most central, but, like the game isn't as fun without this person there. I don't know if you should avoid that. I actually don't think so. But being prepared for, like, making sure that your most central character is played by a player who will show up, I think is like huge. Gosh, I can't, like, the scheduling thing, in addition to all of the time, I'm like, this is a logistical nightmare. And then looking, then reading all of the forms. Oh my goodness.
Just to hit that real quick. I don't think there's anything wrong with having one or two of the characters be like, maybe you could consider them like hinge characters. They're a character upon which something in the story is going to hinge. Doesn't mean that they're more powerful, that they're going to have more screen time, whatever, but there's a hook that's going to play in and that will satisfy everybody.
Yeah, right.
And making sure that those characters are actually played.
Yeah, funnily enough, the last time I ran Concord Olympus, the day of the game, we had the player playing Hera drop, and she was like one of the main characters that the plot hinged on. And it was not her fault. She got COVID and we're like, yes, please stay home. But it meant that we had to scramble to try to like put an NPC in the role to make sure that everything that, that character was connected to still happened. So, but that's, if you've run a lot of LARPs, that's just the thing that you kind of predict will happen. You're going to have at least one or two people drop like the day of the game. and so having other people, if you have other people on your staff, like I have several facilitators that play NPCs and work for me. So if you have people on staff, you can sometimes reassign those roles to them to make sure that that story goes out. But after that happened at the last time I ran the game, we sat down and discussed it, and we decided that Hero was just too important to have as a PC. So she is firmly an NPC now, just because so much of the plot hinges on her.
That's a good point. That's like a really good kind of workaround. If it is really truly a hinge character, either be prepared to pivot to them being an NPC and a game master handling that character, or you, if you are the only GM at the tabletop game, or starting them off as the NPC in the first place. I think that's a great way to handle that. How scary. Like, oh no, the queen of the gods of Olympus is gone. Oh no. And
if you can keep backstories not in any way dependent on character stats, abilities, you know, whatever, you could even keep those separate. Potentially, you could have like, here's six characters that have like all your statty kind of stuff, all your rule stuff, and then there's six backgrounds, and they're, you know, you could interchange them. And just make sure somebody gets the right, the background of like, well, they're the orphan, you know, of the person who's going to turn out to be the bad guy or whatever.
Yeah. I think,
again, more planning.
Right. But it is less of a risk when it is just a one shot rather than a campaign.
Yeah.
And then also once you, if you got a campaign started, it can be a little easier for you to start patching those holes. And I mean, if it's, if you're truly playing a game where like, people can make their decisions and people can die and whatever, like maybe they don't show up and that's fine. I do think that this style is great for the type of GM who does like to write all these giant, like this is like the perfect balance for the GM who wants to write all the big backstories and all that lore and then is always sad that no one is playing their game anymore. Like, well, I mean, you can write all this now and then people will play the things that you want. And yeah, I don't know. I think I'm trying to like see like for me when I was playing, when I started playing role-playing games like this, this would never have flown. Like I wanted to make my own character. I wanted to do my own thing. But I never, even when I've been assigned a character, I've never felt like I was a little doll in a house and being told what to do or a little puppet. I still felt very much like I had agency and I had this person and this character to protect almost, rather than, oh, this is my decision that I've made. And also let me make more risks too. And I think that can come up when you're assigned a character. Like you feel like you're more willing to make a shitty decision, make a bad decision, do something that would do something that is definitely in your character's interest, but would hurt other characters, even though if you, like me personally, I never, like, I always feel bad about doing that. If it's like I'm playing in a role-playing game, I don't want to screw anyone else over, but it kind of gives you permission to be a little slimy if that's what your character's like.
My character, hey, I was given this character and they're kind of a dick.
I mean, it is the solution to the, this is what my character would do, but yeah, actually.
But you know, yeah. And especially if it's like you said, if it's a one shot, because everybody can kind of just like, okay, well, we had fun with this little story and you're not going to keep kind of screwing people over for, you know, session after session.
Yeah, I also like that, and I don't know if this is coming from LARPing or if it's coming from people creating pre-gen characters for demos at cons, but I like that creating characters like this with backstories that people can just walk up and play is a really good way to kind of introduce people who may have not even ever played tabletop or a LARP before. To just give them and go, okay, here's your character, here's what they want, here's what they do, here's who they care about. You don't have to, like, you know, think too hard about it. You don't have to get worried about, like, maybe I'm not doing this correctly, because everything is set up for you and you can kind of slide into this game knowing who you're supposed to be and how you're supposed to act. And then you can use that to build on to create a character that is more like who you want to play or what you think the character would do. Because with pre-created characters, it's always going to be different based on who plays it. Somebody who is playing a pre-gen character, pre-created character, is always going to bring bits of themselves into their play style. And so it's really interesting running games that are different groups of people or different individual people playing the same characters and just seeing just how vastly different these characters turn out in different players' hands.
Absolutely. That's so true. You see that on this stage to a lesser degree. I can imagine that I can easily imagine how much more elevated that is when it's the role-playing game and you're just running around a little room all day acting out this character. I think that kind of speaks to the reusability of this as well. If it's a one-shot, you could even play the same, you could have the same story and the same characters and you mix up the roles and things are gonna churn out a little different. I mean, that could be a tabletop game on its own or a LARP on its own. Like, okay, we did it this way. Now everyone change places and see how it goes out this time. That would be an interesting little experiment. Ooh, now I'm thinking.
And it's if you're getting your characters at the table, right before you're going to play, and it's not something that the GM planned beforehand and cast and did the questionnaire like Joey was talking about. If it's here's a variety of characters with a couple of extras so that the last person doesn't get stuck with no choices. It's also an opportunity for players to experiment and try something that they wouldn't necessarily make for themselves. And for those people, especially if it's a game that kind of delves into human condition a little more, and it's not less of it just like a, punchy fighty adventure game or something. It's an opportunity for somebody to be like, I'm going to put on the skin of someone who's very different from me and kind of get an insight into what that person might go through, at least in some sort of a controlled way. Or for people who are kind of questioning their own place in the world and identity and so forth, it's also an opportunity to kind of try something in a safe place where they can be like, I'm going to be a little different. I'm going to present myself a little differently here and see how that feels and how people react to me.
That, brings up something, and I want to hear Joey's take on this, especially with you. Remind me the name of it again, the name of the Greek gods LARP.
Concord Olympus.
I was like, it's not Lore Olympus. That's something else. Well, our Greek gods, there are technically already genders assigned to them. In the LARP I just did, we kind of were free to change the genders of our characters. Sexualities of our characters were kind of left to well, it doesn't really matter. This is my vampire lover. This is my vampire ex-lover. It doesn't matter. We're all gay vampires. But how did you in that game, and how do you in general handle characters choosing their own those personal identity portions, your pronouns, your gender identity?
So funnily enough, one of the things that we established when we were writing Concord Olympus is that since Greek gods can literally change into anything they want, Zeus was like, I'm a swan, I'm a bull, I'm a shower of gold. It's like, gender is probably not a thing that they worry about. They can choose whatever gender they want to be. And so, we had a lot of people that were playing more genderqueer versions of the gods, more flexibility and malleability. We had one person in the first game who played their god as one gender one night and a different gender the next night. So it's especially with something like Greek mythology, because there's so much transformation that goes on. Don't worry about it. Play whatever gender you want to play as them, because they can literally reshape themselves at will.
Yeah. I think that helps a lot of people too. I can see how it would be icky to play a gender. If I it's not a gender I identify with or identify with anymore, and I don't want to be in a role like that. I think having the flexibility to make those changes and making sure as a GM that you are allowing those changes, especially with a group of strangers, unless you're warning them ahead of time. I do know that there are LARPs out there where the genders of the characters do matter, and then you're put into that role, although it could be like a man could play a woman, for example, in that it's just that the character is. But I think the players need to be warned ahead of time, because gender stuff can get, gender stuff is personal to all of us, of course. Advice, talk to your players. Now make sure everyone's on board. Like, that should be obvious, but it's not always.
I was going to say, a lot of the games where the gender roles are fairly rigid actually explore some aspect of like gender in society, and that's why they keep them that way.
Right.
And it should be on all of them. It should be very obvious in the writing when people are signing up for the game. Like, this is going to explore gender roles. If you're not comfortable with that, that may not be the game for you. It's not a slight on you. It's just not game. Every game is not for every player, and every player not for every game. And you don't want to go to a game where you're going to have a bad time or you're going to struggle with something.
Right.
So I personally prefer to do like gender chaos, basically, like people can pick their own most of the time. But I haven't done one yet that requires like you have to be XYZ. Well, that's not true. I was going to say, I've written games that are like that, because I've written games that are like, you are a girl at an all girls boarding school. But you know from the beginning that you're playing a female character in this environment where being a woman is very fraught, and it's actually part of the gameplay. It's also similar in things like Bluebeard's Bride, where you know you're playing the bride. Right. Although they do have a playset where you're playing with the son of Bluebeard, which is actually pretty cool. I ran it as a demo for Magpie one time, and it's really interesting because it talks about like studying toxic masculinity from like the inside. And they've done some great things with that game.
I think that sounds very fascinating. And like you said, plaster it over like, this is a game that does this, and making sure that if you do have like, I think being upfront with the content warnings, I'm not going to create for myself a character that hits my triggers. I'm not going to do that to myself, but someone might put that in an assigned background because it's important to their story or for whatever reason. And making sure that hey, don't pick this character if blah, blah, blah. Or do pick this character if you want to, blah, blah, blah. Those are, I think, are good strategies. I've run a game with a preset, the Clockwork Dominion game I was talking about. That module had a priest, and they were a man, and a nun who was a woman. Although the gender didn't really come into it, it was just like the religion aspect, and you could have probably messed with it if you really wanted to. But I've never run into a specific problem, an issue like that, but I've also been a very lucky player. So
before we segue, can I share a documentary with all of you? Craig, shut up. You were talking about, you know, the idea of like even assigned role, you know, assigned character can be interpreted different by different players. Different players are going to bring different things to it. You can see that in like if you watch Hamlet done straight out of the, you know, transcript, or, you know, straight out of the play with different people playing Hamlet or Ophelia or whoever. But there's something where you should check out. It's called The Bieber Trilogy. It's a documentary. And it's three vignettes. It starts with the documentarian interviewing a person in 1979 who is named Gary. He calls himself Groovin' Gary. And he's this kind of over the top personality. He's like a big personality, right? And so this all happens. He films this interview with this guy. And then he takes the transcript of that later, years later, and basically makes it as a play, and he gives it to an actor in 1981 and has that actor, without having seen the footage, just reading the transcript, reenact this interview. That actor in 1981 is Crispin Glover.
Oh.
He does it again a third time in 1984, exactly the same way. The actor is Sean Penn. Before they were anything big. And it's really interesting to see the interpretation of this personality through the eyes of two actors. First of all, the person who is just this person, and then two actors who have very distinct, and like we can both, I think we can all like imagine what Crispin Glover kind of acts like what kind of tack he takes on things. And then we can all kind of see Sean Penn and how he approaches things. Check it out. I haven't watched it for many, many years, but it was really fascinating when I did.
Yeah I'll really check cool. it out. I wrote it down. I was also very specifically like thinking about Shakespeare when I was thinking about different casts, but I kind of the opposite way of that would be something like American Horror Story, where the actors are all kind of playing similar archetypes, but that's a different RPG R&D segment. the game design side of this is creating a game where the characters are kind of set for you already. And I thought it paired really nicely with this topic. And it made me think of two games that have received quite a bit of recognition in the past couple of years that use a cast. It already has the characters there. You are not making up your own backstory. You are not making up your own characters. And it is Eat the Reich and Yaziva's Bed and Breakfast. These are two games that have like blown up in terms of like the praise that they're receiving, and Eat the Reich is like, I mean, I've not played either of these. I've just heard them from secondhand. I've read through some of the materials. So Eat the Reich, there's a set of, I haven't pulled up here. Of course you're all vampires or vampire related. I guess. I don't know if they're all exactly vampires. And there's six iconics is what they call them. And they all have their own backstory. And then they all have their own names. And then Yaziva's Bed and Breakfast also has characters, although the characters, some of them have names, some of them are just like one of them's Hey Kid, which is not really a name, but sure. one of them is Gertrude, for example, and they also have backgrounds and things like that. And I find it a little fascinating, because it is certainly not within the style of when we're thinking about Dungeons and Dragons. This is a tradition spawning out of that type of game, which is a kind of pretty relatively open for character creation. And now you're picking up a game, people are buying these games where, no, you don't really get a choice except in this limited list. And I don't have too much experience with this, but I'm very interested in talking about it, even from a theoretical standpoint.
So I've actually, I have had the chance to play Yaziva's. I haven't had a chance to play Eat the Reich yet, but I probably will at some point. But one of the things that I think is very strong about Yaziva's is that even with the pre-generated characters, with the ones that are just characters in the story, it makes the story that you're exploring feel like more cohesive, like almost like you're playing characters in a book. Like you're reading a book and you identify with this character, but in this case, you're actually playing them. And I don't know, there's some sort of like alchemy that goes on with that game where it just feels so cohesive by the use of these characters that are already slotted in to make a difference in the world and the story that's created.
Do you think the game would have been different had J-Dragon allowed players to make their own characters and slotted them in? Do you think what would the differences have been, I guess?
I think it would have been different. I don't necessarily think it would have been bad, but it definitely would have been a different play experience. I think by having these characters that are very obviously part of this world, it makes everything more seamless, everything like more cohesive. I think if they had chosen to allow people to create their own characters, they would still interact with the world, but it wouldn't have this sense of almost like history that these characters have. Like, they've always been a part of this world. They've always had a place in this world. Whereas when you're coming in with a character that's completely new that you've created, you're still kind of trying to find your way. Like you're still picking through things and trying to find your place. Whereas with the pre-created ones, it's like you are literally just sliding into a character in a storybook and you're playing the storybook as you're going along.
And it seems like to me in both of these games, and I actually don't know of any other examples that are quite this way, although I'm certain they exist. Craig waved his hand. It seems like in these games, these are games that have like such a developed setting. Like the setting is super important. Mm-hmm. I mean, the setting in Yuseeva's Bread and Breakfast is the name of the game, and Eat the Reich is so important that it's you're in World War II. Like this,
the setting is World War II. Right, it's like everything you know about World War II.
And I think, like as a game designer, if you're making a game like that, just like we were talking about the GM, like you have to be prepared to do a bunch of work to make that seem real enough. So these characters that you're creating for the game also feel like that kind of sense of belonging that Joey is hinting at. Craig, you waved your hand. What games are you thinking about?
The thing that I thought of, because I so often fall back to like things from so long ago, yesteryear, as it were. And it struck me funny because Jess made the comment about like, these are role-playing games that are based, you know, that kind of came from D&D, and this has been done in D&D. The Dragonlance Chronicles, the trilogy of books, was written up as, I believe, was it 12 or 16 modules that you could buy back in the first edition days, advanced D&D first edition, and you could play the entire story of those books, plus things that didn't get written into the book, even though they got played initially, because originally what happened was people at TSR played the game as these characters, and those characters in the story became the books. And then you could go back and play as Tanis Half-Elven and Goldmoon and Raistlin Majere and so forth, and play through all of those stories and be like, and including ones that weren't in the novels, you know, events that weren't in the novels, so you would have no idea what was going on. And then events that were in the novels where you could basically just reenact, but also the GM could mix things up. And if I remember correctly, there was discussion even in the modules about things you could do differently to shake things up for people who had read the books. And there was also at one point, they put together, I don't remember, it was like a little box set that you could get. And it was when the DVDs first came out for the D&D cartoon, and it came with character sheets from whatever edition of D&D it was at the time. I think it was second edition, of all the characters of Hank the Archer and, you know, Sheila the Thief and everything. And you could, and they were all like fifth, sixth, seventh level characters, and you could play those characters. And there was a point when I had that DVD set and I bought that, and I had the character sheets, where I was like, I really want to just sit down and run people through. I'll watch one of the episodes and I will recreate that story with second edition D&D or whatever it was. And then we will play through it, and I'll give everybody the characters. And then we'll watch the episode after we all play it to see what the writers of the story did, you know, how the story played out differently from what the players did when we ran it. So you could do that sort of thing. And again, speaking to Jess's point, there's setting that is so important and is so built into all of that. I think that a game that has these prepped characters these are the characters you play in the game, almost necessitates it being a very well-developed story, because otherwise, why? Mm-hmm. Why prep these characters if you can't integrate them seamlessly into a setting and give it that as a selling point and as a benefit of playing and a particular experience?
I think even like a light version of this are a lot of playbooks in Powered by the Apocalypse games.
That was literally about what I was about to say.
Well, why don't you carry on? Why don't you carry on?
No, I don't have to. It was just funny that we had the same thought at the same time.
Yeah.
Great minds.
It really is. Like, those playbooks have to be very thematic to the game. They, like, you look at Monster of the Week, And it's very clear that the designers of that game knew the genre and knew the types of characters that were in there. I have experience doing that myself, knowing like, okay, we wanted some punk archetypes and we wanted some 1950s sci-fi archetypes. So we're going to put them in the game. It's just like a mini version of that, where you have the facade, you have the costumes, and then you can act however you want. It's just, you're right that there is a, there's already been a tradition, Craig. And, I haven't done that. I haven't played, these are characters in the TV show that we're going to watch after before, but
that would be a lot of fun, I think.
It would.
And just like for, do a one shot every now and then. But the self being really intrigued by is to get back to the example, the two examples that you, that we were initially talking about is, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe Ziba's is built to have many stories.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you play, Joy, describe to us kind of how it's set up.
So Yuzivas itself is very setting heavy, as we've been discussing. Like, there's a lot in the, just the core rulebook is a lot of, here's what the world is, here's what the bed and breakfast is like, here are the people that visit there, that live there. And there are also, you know, plenty of examples of, you know, here's a story that is occurring, somebody is having a birthday, or somebody has gotten lost and you have to find them. A lot of these are thought up by Jay and everybody else who worked on the book to kind of make it, again, like kind of like a storybook, or maybe like an episode, like if you're watching a TV show, it's like this week on Yaziba's Bed and Breakfast.
Right.
You're going, the characters that are pre-written already have these roles in this world and they follow their roles through a particular story. But it's also, you can also just create your own using all of the setting material that's in that book, because it is like, I would say like 90% setting. It is very, very well developed.
And then the counterpoint to that is Eat the Reich, where, and correct me if I'm wrong, my understanding of it is, I own it, I haven't read the whole thing, I've skimmed it, and I remember the, going through the Kickstarter material, is you are all a bunch of vampires, and your mission, you're being dropped behind enemy lines during World War II, and your mission is to drink all of Hitler's blood. That's the story, and that mm-hmm. is the story every single time you play it. Now, it will be a very different story depending on who's playing what characters are involved, who's playing them, how they're playing them, what angles and directions you take to get to, you know, drinking all of Hitler's blood. But it's
well, it also always ends the same way. You are Hitler in his luxury Zeppelin that's tethered to the communications network inside the Eiffel Tower, according to the Roan Rickendeckard website.
And the that strikes me as, rather than being an episodes of a television show, that strikes me as being like, here's the original and then the remakes.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to do this. We're going to tell this story. We're going to have this movie about vampires going after Hitler one time. And then we're going to do it again. And it's going to be different actors who are going to play the part. And there's going to be maybe even a different GM. So a different director who's going to kind of put a different spin on things and describe things a little differently. And then there's going to be, you know, there's some of the scenes will be, you know, presented that were there the first time. And the next time there might be slightly different things, but it's all going to kind of end. Yeah. Like you said, it's going to make its way toward this particular climax that is, you know, iconic of the series, you know, just like any movie series that has, you know, a trilogy, there's always, you know, the showdown with the Terminator, the final showdown with the Terminator. There's always a final showdown, right? It's just mm-hmm. how that's going to play out. And you can see it in remakes where there's always, you know, any of the story of what is it? Like Bedazzled, you know, there's always going to be the twist at the end of how
I love
get,
that movie.
How you get, the, but it's a you know, the one with that we all know with Liz Hurley and Brendan Fraser as a remake, and it's also going to
wait. That's a remake.
That's a remake.
Yeah,
shut
remake.
Up.
Yeah, and there's it's always going to end with how our protagonist gets the better of the devil. Like how do they use the devil's words and plots against them? Yeah, that's a remake, Jess.
I didn't know that. But
it's a very, very different remake. It's a remake yeah. very much in spirit. But it's, you know, this it's the deal with the devil story. And that's really kind of, when you get down to it, it's every deal with the devil story is kind of that. Mm-hmm. They almost always end with how does our protagonist use the rules of the contract that the devil has gotten them to sign against the devil to get out of the contract.
Or it's Faust.
or it's the spin where it's like, and everything goes poorly and the devil wins.
I can see like this style of game design could work really thematically with a couple of like really zeitgeisty story types, like the multiverse idea. The idea of multiverses would be perfect for a game where mm-hmm. you have the set cast. It works great with like I can imagine someone doing a Shakespeare game, which I honestly, why doesn't that exist yet? It's completely public domain and has been for all of our lives. Someone make a Shakespeare game.
It actually does exist in LARP. I mean, like, there was literally a LARP a few years ago that was inside Hamlet, and it was literally you were playing all of the Hamlet characters, and they ran like 5 or 6 runs of it. So there are specific things that the characters do in Hamlet. They had to hit the story beats, but it was different based on the players playing these roles. It was fascinating. I would love to see someone to do that in tabletop.
Right. I want to see this kind of stuff in tabletop, or even like you're not you're putting on the plays, but you are an actor's troupe or whatever it ends up being. Like, I see like that style of gameplay being great for that, or even doing the we're all connected through past lives, and every time we have the same characters every time, but it's a different game and we're still connected in the very same ways. Like, any of those would be like really adept, in my opinion, to a game where the characters are already there laid out for you.
Just an aside, it's not this type of a game that we're looking at here, but Magpie put out a game called The Play's the Thing, which is about an acting troupe who is going to basically reimagine Shakespeare. What if Ophelia didn't drown and killed Claudius herself? What if Romeo never met Juliet and instead fell in love with Mercutio? Which I would argue Romeo is a little bit in love with Mercutio anyway.
Everyone's in love with Mercutio.
that's true.
That's the true tragedy of Romeo and Juliet, is that Mercutio dies so soon. He's the best character in the play.
He's my favorite character.
Here's my hot take. That's not actually a hot take, because I believe this in my soul. If you were growing up and your favorite character in Romeo and Juliet was Mercutio, you're bisexual. Don't make the rules. I don't make the rules.
I just learned something new about yourself. I did Mercutio's death as a scene when I was auditioning for a Renaissance fair. We had to do a comedic and a dramatic scene. A plague of both your houses. Ask for me tomorrow and you shall find me a grave man.
So many puns in that. Like, it's a very serious scene, but there's so many puns.
Yeah, it was, and that was one of the reasons I kind of wanted to do it, because I was like, I know that I want to turn this into something comedic, but it's got to be serious.
Oh, man. You know what? This is completely unrelated to anything. But one of my favorite, it's actually related to what we were talking about with Shakespeare. One of my favorite things I've ever done in my life was sit in one of my professor's kitchens with a bunch of other people, and we all just read through a Shakespeare play together. And it was so fun, and I want to do that again. And I know that I froze there a little bit, but...
Welcome to Zoom. We got Zoom.
I know. It would be fun to do.
I would be up for it. Okay, I've never had a chance to do it. I've never gotten quite to the point where I got into doing theater stuff outside of the Ren Faire for a number of reasons. But yeah.
I know. A lot of us are nerds.
Just not Hamlet. I don't have 4 hours.
A lot of us are. I mean.
let's stick with a comedy. Stick with something that's going to be done in 2 hours.
Joey, do you have any final thoughts on us for pre-gen characters, backstories, preset games?
Mostly just that unless the game itself comes with it, it's a fair amount of work for the GM on the front end. But once that work is done, a lot of the game is going to get carried on the players by just taking what you have given them and interpreting it. And it's like one of the things in Power by the Apocalypse, one of like the principles that's in almost every one of those games is to play your characters like a stolen car. Like, get them into trouble, wreck them, make them take risks, that sort of thing. And I definitely feel like when you give someone a character that's established to just kind of like make their own, they're definitely more likely to take risks, which is like what Jess was saying earlier. It is, like I said, a little bit more work on the front end, but it's really rewarding kind of both for the players and the GM in the long run.
Yeah, definitely don't be afraid of it. Joey, thank you so much for coming on the podcast again.
Thank you for having me.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And I'm so glad that you're the one who chose this topic, because I know I was like, this is a LARP, and Joey just picked it, and this is a LARP topic for sure. Where can we find you and your stuff?
You can find me on A Wayward Moon on Twitter. I'm going to call it Twitter forever. Elon Musk can suck it.
it's an established character.
Exactly. You can find me at A Wayward Moon on Twitter. You can find Drowning Moon Studios at drowningmoonstudios.com. And also, I will be doing a Kickstarter for a slasher horror game in October of this year called Final Girl Rising. So that is up on the preview page, up on Kickstarter. It's kickstarter.com/Final Girl Rising.
So cool. I'm so excited for October gaming. You can find me on the internet at Joska, or sometimes at Jess is awful. Figure out which one is where. That's part of the fun. And wannabegames.com is my website.
And you can find me at Nerdburger Craig on various social medias. Nerdburger Games is the website. Games are available on DriveThruRPG. As of right now, Capers Expanded is funded on Kickstarter and continuing to.
Yes.
We're putting this is the final hurrah for the Capers game line. So one last round of all the other ideas that I had in my head, I spewed them all out into 64 pages of supplement. A bunch of stuff was written by other people too. So I spewed ideas at them, and then they actually wrote really cool stuff. So check that out before it's over very early in October.
Thank you to our opening and closing theme song, which is Avil by Steph Sachs, licensed under Creative Commons. Thank you, Steph Sachs. And thank all of you for listening. Next time, the part of Craig will be played by Joey. The part of Jess will be played by Craig. And I will be playing Joey. And we'll see you back here next time. Bye.
Bye.